Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Jeffrey Fidel. He's a doctor who refuses to live his life medicated for bipolar 1 disorder. In near complete solitude, he endured nearly a year of intense mental anguish, utilizing mainly the ancient teachings of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. He learned how to connect to a voice originating from his heart. The voice within teaches him that our true identity is beyond thought and that we and the universe are one. Dr. Fidel is now sharing these ancient teachings to help others discover their answer inside through his book, One MD's Inward Journey to Liberate Himself from Mental Suffering, and the help it offers for those diagnosed bipolar, mentally ill, or depressed, and through his website content and his speaking appearances. Dr. Fidel graduated magna cum laude with a Bachelor of Arts degree from Brandeis University in Waltham, Mass. He earned his Doctor of Medicine degree from Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. Dr. Fidel is a board-certified MRI fellowship-trained diagnostic radiologist who completed both his residency and fellowship trainings at the University of Miami in Miami, Florida. And so let me welcome Dr. Fidel. Once again, how are you doing tonight?
Fine, David, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, fine, that's a state of mind, yes?
Yes. Any language can never capture what something is. So fine is yes. It's a thought attempting to describe an experience which is intrinsically indescribable.
I like that very much. Well, you know, people can answer that question in so many different ways. And I think that it's important that people watch the language that they attach to their state of mind, don't you?
Well, the language that we use a lot of times, to be careful, that's kind of, if people are using attacking language, so to say, it's usually their inward state is usually a little bit imbalanced, and they're projecting their anger outward. So normally,
right,
if we see anger in the world or use of language that is offensive, it's really not that the person is consciously trying to attack the other person. It has more to do with the suffering within that person. So it's an important understanding to really know that in our heart, that many people are suffering in the world, and they're taking out their suffering on other people.
That's a very important point. And I think that a lot of people don't have any understanding of that and take things rather personally, which aren't directed necessarily at them. It all is about where a person is at, and that we're only responsible for ourselves and our own actions, and not the actions of others. And we can choose not to react, but to act in the moment and stay on level ground.
Yes. In the end, we must all walk our own path. No one can walk it for us, and that's important. We ultimately are responsible for our own level of consciousness. And by doing this inner work on ourselves, this is really the best means that we can come to a greater sense of inner peace. But, you know, we are the only ones that can give ourselves this gift.
True. Well, let's take a look back in time at your life, what it was like before you came to your current understandings, what it was like to experience active mental illness, and what it's like now.
So up until age 20, I didn't really have what would be considered a happy childhood. I really went through the hoops of what I thought was expected in life. By my parents, you know, to go to college. I really had no direction. By the time I got to age 20, I was already having thoughts of not wanting to live anymore. And it was that time I began medication for a diagnosis of depression. Then 8 years later, when I finished my radiology residency and I was about to go into private practice, the trauma of that reality hit me, and then that's when I went into this other state of mind that would be labeled as bipolar type 1. I then, my mind was stabilized by the medications, and I practiced radiology for about 15 years. So up until that point, I was going along just fine, and then what happened was I got divorced, and then my dog died, and then I decided I didn't want to practice medicine, and then I also decided I was going to throw my meds down the drain. And this all happened in a very short period of time. I just risked it all just to find out the answer to what this all was about, meaning my life. I was willing to just risk it all. When I threw the meds away, I thought that I was cured many times. But not knowingly, the thoughts in my mind were becoming my reality, and I was unknowingly seeping into states which would be labeled as psychoses, because everything or every vision in my head at the time was my reality. So whether they be voices in my head or visions, and I had all these voices and visions, many which were telling me to kill myself. So at the time, those voices and visions were my reality, but I went on in these states for long, long periods of times, refusing at all costs, I will not go back to the hospital, I'm going to find out what this is all about. Luckily, I had also run into some of the more ancient teachings, namely the Tao Te Ching, and just through luck, when I got to the point of having voices to kill myself, I was able to find there's essentially another voice within myself that was telling me not to kill myself, and I followed that voice for months, the one that was helping me and telling me not to kill myself. And I just kept following that voice, and I was actually afraid to ever leave that voice again. So I almost had to relearn society from scratch once again. And then over the months to come, I had realized that all the suffering that I was enduring was just thinking that those thoughts were who I was and everything that was in my mind. But now just coming to the realization that they were just thoughts. They have nothing to do with my identity whatsoever. They're just thoughts of things that I had or a conceptual self, so to say, that was developed over my entire lifetime. And so now it's kind of like my thoughts don't cause me suffering anymore. Thoughts actually are just useful for my day-to-day activities, and I live just in the present moment. It's really where life occurs, is in this moment of now, and that's really what I found through the whole journey inward.
Right. Can you describe how it is that you're able to remain in the present moment so that those thoughts don't distress you?
Well, knowing that the present moment is where life occurs, it's always in the moment of now. And I think much of these teachings are coming to light. We see Eckhart Tolle. We see the message is just coming forth very strong. Live in the now. Live presently.
Yes.
So even I bring my mind's attention to this moment of now. So even when we speak here, I'm like focused on this moment. Should thoughts come and go, that's fine. I mean, I still have thoughts that can say things in my head, but it's really the choice of the beingness or the existence that we all are, whether we allow those thoughts to dictate our behavior. In other words, we have a choice. If we have a thought that comes in our head when we're looking in the refrigerator that says, I want to eat the pizza, we can either impulsively act on the thought that comes to mind and just act right out on that thought, or our beingness, you know, the part that reacts to thought, meaning the physical form, it, you know, it has a choice to just not, to allow that thought to come through, and then another thought comes. So it's really our decision whether we want, we, the beingness of who we are, has that decision of whether we want to act on what thought comes into our mind. Impulsiveness is pretty much what we're seeing a lot, is that, you know, if people just act on every thought that comes in their head, that's kind of impulsive. To be able to sit back is a discipline, let a thought come, let a thought go, and whether we attach to it, it's really up to us.
Well, I liked what you were saying about choice. I mean, we are responsible for our lives, and in so doing, every experience that we have, every thought, every action, every word that comes out of our mouth is indeed a choice, and we're responsible for that. I had a guest on last week who had written a book about choice, and his premise was that there were just two choices to make each step of the way. And I thought that was interesting. I'd never considered that possibility. But what would you say about, can you elaborate a little bit more on the power of choice?
Yes, well, human beings, and yet we're in language again, and this is, you know, much of my teachings are non-duality, where there's no more language left.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we label ourselves human beings or humans or men or women or whatever words we use. Basically, we're all the same in that regardless of our belief systems, which are acquired mostly dependent on where we grow up, what really makes us all alike as humans is that we're aware. In other words, really that's what defines us as being alive, is our awareness. The clinical definition of death is pretty much when we deem that someone else has lost their ability to be aware of their environment. That's really how we define them. So pretty much the human form is that very field of awareness that has come forth in the universe, or whatever name we want to give it, universe, existence, what have you, that we're woven into. There's no separation between us and this existence. So this existence has become aware of itself, and thoughts are just kind of like forms that come and go, that we be, that we are aware of. So we, as this awareness, kind of have a choice to watch the thoughts come and go, kind of like clouds forming in the sky and then dissipating once again. So we, as this field of awareness, have a choice whether we're going to attach to that thought, meaning we're going to act out on that thought that comes into our mind. That's our choice. Or we sit back and we allow the next thought form to come and go. And so really that's our choice, is to, you know, decide which one of these thoughts are most in line with our consciousness. And, you know, I guess that's the discipline, is to really, when one is really true to themselves, they do or perform actions that are really most in line with their true nature, which is love. You know, what we grew up, what we started, we all started off in that state of, you know, love and acceptance and innocence, every one of us. And then that's really the true nature of humanity, is in that state.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what a bipolar 1 diagnosis is and why you couldn't accept the diagnosis or live the rest of your life medicated.
Yeah, this was, you know, for me, I guess it was like a pioneer. I didn't know that it was going to happen, that I would actually get to the point. When I threw the meds away, I didn't know that I'd have to endure this much suffering. I actually didn't think it was going to, I thought I'd be able to just do it and not have to go through like a year and a half of madness in order to get to this point. But, you know, in the end, with any, you know, but a part of me, of course, is an explorer. So I needed to find this truth for myself. You know, this was my personal decision. And I want to make it very clear to any of the listeners here that I'm not recommending in any regard that people actually try this. Just like someone had to maybe be the first person to go to the moon or try something, I considered myself an explorer in this manner. I had many options to go back to a doctor. I almost Baker acted myself several times. I didn't know how long I could endure this mental suffering. So I want to make that very clear to the listeners. I'm not in any regards recommending this. But... you know, it all these thoughts that were happening in my mind was causing all the suffering, because everything that I saw in my mind, all the thoughts, that was my reality. And when voices are in my mind telling me to kill myself at the time, that, you know, that caused, of course, immense suffering, because I thought that meant that I should actually kill myself. Whereas now, if I have a thought of that nature, it doesn't mean anything to me. It's just a thought, and another thought will come. But at that time, that happened. So any labeled psychiatric person, you know, whether they're labeled as depressed, bipolar, anxious, obsessive compulsive, schizophrenic, in the end, really what's causing their suffering is that identification with those thoughts in their mind. And that's really what the root cause of the suffering is. And the medications really are numbing the mind. Just like if one is to drink alcohol or take any other drugs, medicine is, or prescription medicine is very similar. The mechanism of action is not perfectly well understood. That's why there's many side effects. But the end result is to numb the mind in one way or another. I guess the benefits of the prescription drugs is that, unlike alcohol or other illicit drugs, the person is still able to perform their job in society. Whereas when one is very drunk, it's very hard to perform a job as a truck driver, whereas if they're taking a prescription meds, they can still have the effect of a numbed mind, but not lose the motor coordination necessary to drive their truck.
Right. Well, that's it's a very interesting premise, and I certainly respect you for that, and I appreciate what you say about how you're not prescribing this approach for everyone that has accepted a label. They're just labels, and different strokes for different folks is the title of my program goes. Let's talk about the title of your book. What exactly is it?
So the title of the book is it's labeled as I, but if one opens up the book, what it is it's just a vertical line, because it could either be I or it could be one. It's really up to the mind of the interpreter what a vertical line is. So I actually changed the subtitle in the interim since it went out, and I named it just to clarify that a little more. I said I unnameable, meaning that a symbol can never replicate what essence is. So as soon as one opens up that book, I explain, even when I say I right now, and I'm speaking to you and I say I never mean I, because I is reductive, because I can't be I, because an I doesn't recreate the me. So, I is just... I was actually thinking about how I even became an I, and I traced it back, actually, what was helpful to watch my son growing up, and when he started to learn pronouns, how he started to phonetically, and when I say he, I mean his mind started to pick up that phonetic I with that meaning, like I was watching him learn it, and then I started to understand, wow. That's how he's starting to learn himself. You know, in school, he's being taught language, and he's acquiring these phonetical sounds in his words, in his mind, and he's building a conceptual identity right before my eyes, the same way I did when I was a child, and the same way everyone else does when they're learning the language. And all of a sudden, I was just kind of mesmerized, how this whole I thing has become so important. But I was like, everyone's learning the same pronoun I, which I think there was no I until I think the year 1400 or so. I think that's when that pronoun first came out to refer to the self as I. So if we go back, 10,000 years before, I don't know when human language evolved, but, people were still people without their names. So really, humanity, before they were even named humanity, we have this intrinsic existence, and that's truly who we are. It's just that pure beingness. Whether or not we acquired language, we still have that intrinsic beingness.
Well, I had to ask you what the title was because I wasn't sure if it was I or one. So thank you for that explanation.
You're welcome.
Who are you trying to help with the book?
So I'm really reaching out for an audience that wants to look into themselves in a way to heal themselves from within. So these are really, I think, the people that I want to help. So in order to get to this phase, through this inward journey, I've developed certain teachings by kind of reliving over and over again how it was that I was able to get to this point. So the people that are interested in finding alternatives to supplement, at least at this point, you know, there's many people that are suffering. So I've developed different ways to help people by learning to sit and become more present and observing thoughts without attaching to thoughts and forgiving within ourselves, which is truly the most magnificent thing that we can ever do. And in fact, all the religions teach this. And, you know, I don't have any religion anymore, because what I was able to do was, and any human being can do this, this is actually the greatest medicine. You know, if I were to write a prescription for someone, this is the medicine I would give, is to come to the understanding that having a perception of anger towards another person or towards ourselves doesn't do anything for us. And for to develop the strength to forgive another and to forgive ourselves is the great liberator of so much suffering in the world. If we can just come to the understanding, as I said before, is that people that do these unconscious acts, it's always based upon their own state of inner suffering. They're really projecting outwards their inward state. So the ability to forgive, for example, I had a perception in something that happened to me in my childhood, and I could not get over that. So when I was finally able to get enough strength to unconditionally forgive, or love your enemy like as much as you'd love yourself, so to say, to get to that point of just true 100% unconditional forgiveness is really a medicine that no drug can ever give us. So these are kinds of like the things that I, you know, I'm starting out and trying to, you know, lead people to, or guide people inward so that they can start to heal themselves in this way.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Let's talk about the ego. What is the egoic self?
The word ego.
Yeah.
The word ego, I think, is the most misunderstood word in all these teachings. So ego or egoic self is really the conceptual self. What ego is really pointing to is that attachment or identification with thought. So an egoic self is really, all Western science is dealing with this conceptual self or the egoic self, which is the thought-based identity, the attachment of our existence to these words that come up in our minds. That's the egoic self. When we human beings attach to our stories, whatever stories we think that we are, that is the formation of an egoic self. Our lifetime's accumulation of knowledge in thought, that's the egoic self. And that's creating a huge amount of suffering, because if the egoic self is having thoughts like, I want to kill myself, that thought-based identity hears those words and thinks that those words are who the person is. So when those words come through the mind of an individual, they can actually now take the beingness of them and take their, you know, take action on that thought and actually end their life. So the egoic self is that very conceptual self or the thought-based identity. And that's why almost all of modern psychiatry is looking to the mind or to the brain, what parts of the brain is forming the self. And that's this egoic self that they're looking at. But the non-dual self, and this is what I, you know, this is, the non-dual self is just not a self at all. It's just knowing that we're inseparable from the existence that we're woven into. And that, obviously, we're not going to find that in some places of our brain. And in fact, if they find any of the intelligence of this nature, they'll find it in our heart, because that's where I was able to find all this information, was our heart is actually more intelligent than our mind, and the ancient teachings are really what allowed me to discover this within myself. And every human being has this inside of themselves.
Well, I once had somebody tell me, gave me this bit of advice, which seemed like a real gem, and that was to think with your heart. And, you know, based on what you're saying, that's what we really need to do if we're going to let go of the ego itself. Now, it sounds also, let me back up for a minute when you were talking about forgiveness. Is that the pathway to letting go of the egoic self?
Forgiveness is the way to the heart. In order for us to get to the heart itself, we need to forgive, because until we forgive, we're stuck in the mind. Because the mind keeps saying, and this was my journey inward, the mind kept saying to me, "You can't forgive. Not after what that's happened. How can you possibly forgive?" So the thoughts were what was not allowing me to go into the being of myself, to my heart. Those incessant thoughts, and when I continued to listen to those thoughts, I wasn't able to bring my awareness down into the heart. And then there is a state where we can quiet our minds to an actual state where our mind no longer is thinking. In this state, that's when we can actually hear the voice from our heart. Eckhart Tolle speaks about it. You know, he says stillness speaks, and this is what all the ancient teachings point to, is that in the complete state of stillness, we can start to hear our inner voice, or our voice of consciousness. And this is really who we are as human beings. It's this inside voice. This is where our truest nature or truest self comes from, is this inner voice that is really pure consciousness itself. This is like the consciousness that is of the existence. And this is why going into ourselves is really... That's why this modern lifestyle of achieving on the outside is really not, and that's what happened for me, is that no matter how much I achieved in my life outside, whether it be success as a physician or the friends or what have you, I didn't have this inner sense of being. You know, no one had taught me that, so I had to discover this for myself. But this everyone has, and I think that's why mindfulness teachings and all these more ancient teachings are coming back. I think people are starting to discover this, that it's just our true nature is returning once again.
And is all of that what brings us to the present moment?
The present moment is always where life is, and that understanding is so very important, because whether we're in thought or we're not in thought, thought is kind of like can put up a veil and hide us from the moment of now. A simple example is we can be driving our car and we can be deep in thought. They call it like road hypnosis. For 10 minutes, we lose complete awareness that we're driving, and then all of a sudden we come back and we're like, where were we? Well, we were so deep in thought that we actually were not aware that we were in the present moment anymore. And that's really, some people spend their entire day so deep in thought that they're no longer aware that they're in the moment. And really, that's what's going on with, you know, someone that's diagnosed schizophrenic when I was in these states of mind that were labeled, that would be labeled schizophrenic, my mind was so immersed in visual thought, which are so powerful, that I literally lost complete awareness of every single outside environment. I didn't know who was president, and I lost awareness of the rest of my body because my mind was just consumed with thought. So in order to get out of all those thoughts was what enabled me to to come back and then to finally realize that all those were thoughts. And that was really a large part of what I learned through all this.
That's pretty amazing. Can you tell us how your identity is different now from what it was when you were more thought-based? I mean, you've described that as we've talked, but I wondered if you could concentrate a little bit more on that.
Yes, it's much different now because I just have a better sense of being. And so by having the love and acceptance inside of myself now, I'm not modifying my behaviors, which was a subconscious thing, by the way, in order to please other people. So it's just I have just inner peace that's not related to how people respond on the outside, whereas before it was like subconsciously I was very aware, like if someone said something wrong to me or like that used to offend me almost, but now it's more that I understand that if someone ever said something wrong to me, it has nothing to do with me. And now, you know, I just have this inner sense of being, and that kind of just, it's just a greater awareness that other people are suffering, and it has nothing to do with me if someone's not nice or someone says something to me. It's just, I understand now because I was like that, suffering, and that was my life. I walked around as a very angry individual, very sensitive to what other people said to me and very sensitive to everything that was outside of myself. And now it's more, I found this inside of myself, and when someone is acting in that way, there's just a better understanding that they're acting that way, nothing to do with me, but everything, you know, they're suffering, and I understand that.
Have you suffered since you've come to these new awarenesses of self?
Well, things still happen in life. It's not, once I get to the realization that the present moment is the only moment that exists, that doesn't guarantee me that, you know, things still may happen. However, my thoughts don't bother me whatsoever. And if I know if there's suffering, it could only be my mind that's creating suffering. So in the end, I do understand that things can still happen to me in life, and no matter what happens to me in my life, I also understand those must be accepted for what they am, for what they are. So it's not like, you know, you get a ticket out of jail free once you reach the state of just understanding that life is now and all is to be accepted. You know, but life still happens, and really life then just becomes the meditation. So that's really the understanding.
Well, let's talk a little bit about acceptance. I once heard it said that acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. What would you say to that?
Well, acceptance is really, regardless of what happens, whether we want it or not, it's to be accepted. I'll give you a perfect example of how the mind didn't want to accept something. 2 weeks ago, I was doing some plumbing myself, and I don't know how to do plumbing, and the pipe burst,
uh-huh.
And my house was going underwater real fast.
Uh-huh. Oh, boy.
So my mind, the thoughts were cursing me out, calling me how stupid I was. So regardless of what was going on in my mind, the reality of it was my house was flooding, and I knew I had to accept that. So that's what I'm saying is that, and of course, you know, whatever happens in our lives, our minds might want it otherwise, meaning we might have thoughts to wish for a different situation. But once something happens, to not accept means really to create thoughts that are in denial of what truly is. So, you know, if I broke my shoulder and I keep saying to myself, I wish I didn't go over that, I didn't go down that ski hill and do that, I'm such an idiot. That doesn't change the fact that my shoulder is not broken. I'm just now telling myself a story all day. It's kind of like I'm listening to a narrative while my shoulder remains broken. So acceptance is really just being present. And whether we're thinking or not, the isness of the or the reality of the moment of whatever it is will continue. So non-acceptance is really the creation of thought processes that are in denial of what truly is. And that's really the conceptual story that we tell ourselves that could deny this isness.
Can we change our stories?
Well, we can certainly direct our being to do more conscious acts, and that's really, you know, in that way, that's changing our stories because, you know, thoughts in a way direct our behaviors. You know, there's not to be denied that thought has a purpose in this, but to just change our thoughts in order to make us feel better, that's kind of... In other words, if we're in bed and we're just thinking happy thoughts, in the end, those happy thoughts don't really work very well. You know, if it's just what's more useful actually is to allow ourselves to bring our mind's attention to the area that we might subconsciously protect. In fact, in much medicine today, you know, people have an aversion to pain, a very large aversion to pain. So instead of allowing the mind's attention to go towards this unusual sensation, the initial impulsive thing to do is just to reach for the drug to take away what's been labeled pain. So there's a large fear of going to the unknown sensation. And that's kind of non-acceptance in a way, to just reach immediately for a drug without allowing the experience to come forward.
Well, a while ago you said some thoughts are useful. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, thoughts that will kind of contribute to more conscious behaviors, because in the end what thoughts do, and in fact thoughts evolve to help us, if there's a lion chasing us, you know, this is how the intellect evolved to enable our survival. It's how the human species, I guess, if a lion's chasing after us and we know a lion can't swim, we're smart enough to go into the ocean and not fight the lion. You know, we have that intellectual knowledge, or, you know, to build tools that are useful for us. And in that way, thoughts are useful because they're used for productive purposes. So any thought that's used in a productive manner, thoughts that we can use to help people, like I'm trying to now teach people these things to help themselves, those are useful thoughts. But cyclical, repetitive thoughts that really don't serve us any purpose, this habitual thinking of just like if someone cuts us off on the road and we remain angry meaning we create repetitive cycles. I can't believe this guy cut me off. What a nerve. That type of thinking really serves zero purpose. So to get out of that habit of those types of thoughts and really train ourselves to have, you know, if we're going to have thoughts, to kind of put them to more useful activities.
That makes sense. Let's talk some more about love. What's your definition of love?
So really, love to me is just giving another person that presence. The greatest gift we could ever give another human being is just to be there for them. And to just honor that presence. Really, nothing needs to be said. And I think, you know, the romantic ideal love is that, you know, when two people look in each other's eyes and there's no words that need to be spoken. It's just that 100% pure presence. It's almost like a meditative state where it's just that. So that's really what love is. It's not really about, you know, a lot of love, and then this is what a lot of relationships are. They're very subconscious means of manipulating people or controlling them in a way that, you know, it dates back to kind of like, if they feel their partner is not giving them the love that they need, then there might be an anger that develops, and then there's a subconscious emptiness in the person where they might feel that that person owes them this love, and then there's this manipulation control aspect, and then it's no longer love. Love is more just, you know, two people present together and not really getting into these subconscious control battles, which are very common. And that, of course, that's much of my relationships up until this whole thing had happened. That it formed a very large component of what I understood relationships to be, was like the other person almost owes me this love in some way, and if they leave me, then, you know, I need to figure out a way to get them to behave in a way so I get that love back. Very subconscious and very not really a very comfortable kind of love.
No, not comfortable at all.
Yeah, it's a lot of fear. Very subconscious, but, you know, in my example, that's really what many of my relationships were, is fear-based relationships. It's just going back to very early traumatic events that with my early relationships when my first girlfriend broke up with me. And, you know, from that moment on, I guess the heartache that I experienced at that time, I didn't want to experience that again. And so I learned behavior sets of how to act so that that didn't happen again. But the trade-off was that I could no longer feel anymore. And that was really what I had given up, was the ability to feel. So I never got hurt again, but then I never felt, you know, I never trusted another woman again in the way I did before. That kind of changed my relationship. So that was another part of my journey inward, was to re-experience that full heartache again that I was subconsciously protecting since a long time ago.
Well, we tend to repeat these cycles until we can learn to let go. And fear certainly is a very real human emotion. But it seems to me that that all comes from thought, doesn't it? thought
yes,
and how it
much of it comes
experience.
From much of it comes from thought and what the thoughts will say. You know, my example is there'll be words that'll say, don't go to your heart, don't feel that again. Or it'll just be as simple as the easier thing to do, and what I used to do out of fear is just you get on the phone and you talk to another person about it without going there. You know, if someone breaks up, the first thing you do is you call up and you tell your story to someone else about how someone else has wronged, you know, what they did to you and the whole story. You know, or reaching for a drink or whatever, anything to take away from confronting what you know, intrinsically is a fear of feeling something inside that, you know, there's a recollection that, oh, I don't want to go there again inside of myself, and I'll do anything not to go there. So that's kind of, you know, it's not fun to feel heartbreak again, but if we don't feel it again, then that's kind of like we give up that ability to feel as well. It's the trade-off.
Well, feeling is an important part of being human, isn't it?
Very important. I think I consider it a great strength. I think somehow I developed as a man, I wasn't supposed to cry, but there is nothing wrong with crying and feeling. That's I consider it stronger than the way I used to be and put up kind of like a macho front. To me, it takes a lot more strength to feel because it's really going and feeling that, going to that experience and not kind of bragging about to the guy friends is what I, you know, used to do, like, yeah, tell the story. No, the feeling of it was a lot. It took more bravery to go there than it did to call up my friends and go out, you know, so.
Well, let me ask you, are people really different from one another?
No, not really at all. All human beings are essentially the same. The only thing that differentiates, and this is how we all relate to each other so well. I mean, we all can relate to our experiences very well. The main factor of what differentiates one human from another is really our acquired belief system. And that's largely dependent on where we grew up or whatever we learned. But behind that belief system, that's really, we're all the same. So that's, you know, this is there. I don't see how there could be any argument otherwise. All the wars that are going on are basically based upon difference in belief systems. But when we look inside of ourselves, then we get to see that we're all the same. And this is what I found.
Same here. How important is respect?
Oh, respect is very important, and it starts with self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
And when we really respect ourselves and we take care of ourselves, I think that's our main responsibility as human beings is really to find these things for ourselves. And once we find these things in ourselves, then it goes to the outside. It's really the way it works. We find these in ourselves. We become more conscious. We give ourselves, because in the end, we're our greatest teacher. This is really what all the Buddhist teaching is. When the Buddha, the teaching, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. That means the teacher within us. That's what that means. When we're really ready to find this inside of ourselves and be true to ourselves and listen to our consciousness or our heart consciousness or our soul or whatever one wants to call it, that's when we really truly learn. We find it in ourselves, and then that's really what our purpose is here, is to find these things in ourselves and then to share it with other people. And you know, this is I guess this is where I'm starting to go out and teach in this regard. This is, I guess, my calling, so to say, after this whole 43 years, I'm 45 now, of living one way, and then after this whole, you know, inward journey, now I've found that it's kind of like I want to share these things with other people so that they can find these things inside of themselves.
Well, I am not beating myself up, but I had a significant question and I didn't write it down, so I just need to let it go. And that's growth for me, because as is the case for so many people, we have a tendency to not respect ourselves and beat ourselves up over silly things. So let me finish up by asking how people can find you, number one.
My website right now is still under construction, but it's live. It's www.jeffreyfidelmd.com. That's JeffreyFidelmd.com. And the book is on that website, or the book's also on Amazon. And it's probably best to just use my name to find it, because it's I, unnameable. But I find if you put Jeffrey Fidel MD, it's, the search capability is easier to find the book.
Okay.
In that way.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for joining me tonight. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, David, for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, now it's time to come to a close. So let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience, who can and will have a spiritual experience when we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, Jeffrey.
Good night, David. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.